This is episode number 9 of Ben Lee in Quarantine. And it's the second episode that Ben and I, Max Quinn, hello, will spend talking about Ben's journey with doTERRA essential oils and multi-level marketing companies. I don't know if it feels this way to you, but from the outside, there's something about MLMs that can feel a bit culty to me. So I wanted to put that in front of Ben, and you'll also hear Ben's thoughts on why MLMs reward fanaticism in the way that they do. But first, some long overdue hat chat. And listeners, I gotta be honest with you here, Ben's new hat is a doozy. So let's go there first. Stick around for Ben Lee in Quarantine. Hello, Ben.
Hey, mate.
Day 10.
Day 10. Just got through the second COVID test of quarantine, which is a real, it's almost like a bar mitzvah, or it's like a type of graduation into, you know, being certified as non-infectious.
Yeah, great. And how are you going? You still waiting on the results?
Yeah. Apparently, it's funny because you don't get results unless you're positive.
Ah.
Which is sort of like, it's like a recipe for aggravating anxiety in a way. I think they're like, you're COVID negative, but you are neurotic.
I want to start the episode with a bit of hat chat because I was being facetious.
I've got a good hat. Hang on. I'm going to put a good hat on.
Dude, please. Okay, great. So just as a reminder, listeners, the other day I made a joke about how artists sometimes might reinvent themselves by coming back with a brand new hat.
I'll have to do headphones underneath. It's a pretty good hat.
It is a good hat. Okay, so Ben, how would you describe this hat?
This hat is an extremely wide-brimmed, I mean, it's technically, I think, a fedora, but it's wide-brimmed to the point of, it's making a statement with its width. But my whole journey with hats has been kind of interesting because when I was 18, I got to America. I did one of my first recording sessions of a song called Burn to Shine that was on Breathing Tornadoes. But initially, it was being recorded as I got invited to do it as the closing credits for this film called Best Men. And The director had this idea of T-Bone Burnett producing it, who's, cool. He went on to do Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And he's, he was in Bob Dylan, Elvis Costello's bands.
Early Counting Crows records.
Yeah. And he put this band together for the song, and it was really sick. Like, the band was Jim Keltner on drums, who's like famous John Lennon, played with everybody on drums. Russell Simmons from the Blues Explosion on percussion. Sick. Ben Montench from Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers on organ. Money Mark on piano. John Bryan on banjo, and Greg, I forgot his last name, he's Tom Waits' cousin, on upright bass.
Amazing.
So it was this incredible band, and we recorded live. But anyway, I show up in this, like, at 18 years old, I'm still essentially like, almost like a skate punk, whatever. Who's like, I'm just like wearing my baggy clothes and, a Sydney, Bondi larrikin type outfit. And there's like half these guys are in what you'd call like not formal wear, but like suit jackets, hats. Like, I'd never been around musicians in hats before. And what I realized was that like, in LA, there was a certain, these are like legacy outfits, that like if you're a serious motherfucker who plays music in LA, you wear a hat. And John,
you own that hat.
That's right. And John Bryan particularly, who was just, he was amazing. This was before he'd done like Fiona Apple stuff. And, he was just kind of, I think before Elliot Smith. Oh yeah, way before that. He was just this young, kind of beautiful looking musical genius wearing this hat. And I was like, man, when I, at a certain point, I will reach the confidence to carry a hat in the sense of like, the burden of the musical lineage of hat wearers in the past. It was only about a year ago that I started feeling like I'm ready to wear a hat, and I just started wearing hats, and it's cool. It was a, it was a kind of symbolic shift.
It's more than just a piece of flair.
Yeah, and it also served a double purpose for me because I started getting this sort of like thinning up on top. And what happened was I saw a photo of myself because sometimes I just like lose myself in the music and look down at my guitar. And I realized what the audience is getting is they're just getting the solar panel. Like they are, they're just getting full. And I was like, it's actually not fair to them. And I thought you wear a hat out of respect for not showing the audience an increasing bald spot, you know?
This is true. And like with the different types of hat that you can own, perhaps more than any other garment for men, I think are such sartorial sociological signifiers. For example, like the Kangol knit hat, which might say such things about you as I perform slam poetry to a jazzy backbeat.
But wait, is that like what Quentin Tarantino would wear or something like
that? Samuel Jackson.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Or as you exactly say, it might say I'm bald, or the backwards baseball cap might say I could beat you up, or I love sports, or I have a particularly small area on the back of my neck that I need to protect from the hot sun. Obviously, right. It's all about how you wear whatever you choose to wear and whether that is, you know, blazing your own trail or paying homage to Russell Coit or Rosie O'Donnell, what have you.
Yeah, I wasn't thinking of paying tribute to Rosie O'Donnell, but sure. And and I look at it almost in terms of there's a traditional aspect to a hat that it's almost like part of chivalry or something. And as an artist, there's something about the traveling, I've forgotten the term for it.
Like a bard?
Yeah, a bard or a troubadour. Or there's some aspect like a hat and travel. And the idea that you are, I guess for me, what's interesting about, you know that Bob Dylan line, to live outside the law, you must be honest? There was something about the lifestyle of an artist and the lack of accountability of it, in which showing up to a new place, your initial presentation of yourself as a human of integrity becomes important because you're free of some of the burdens of normality, you know, in a sense, like everyday life. And there's something about showing like gentlemanliness to me that is important.
Well, it's Keb Mo, right? It's a guitar and a hat and a suitcase making a first impression.
Yeah, cool. Something like that, exactly.
Mm. I have some follow-ups on what we talked about yesterday as well on doTERRA. But yeah. I wanted to start here. Yesterday, you talked a little bit about a natural resizing that occurs for you after you have completely immersed yourself in one of your new hobbies or interests. And then you were saying how it kind of finds its natural place in your, we'll call it like an inner metaphysical hierarchy. I'm wondering what it takes for that to happen for you. Is it just time?
I usually feel like a hunger for it. It's like food. I love learning. And at a certain point, I become satiated where I can carry a conversation about a subject. I have my own thoughts, my own feelings about it. It has become part of the reframing of the way I see the world and what my value system is. And yeah, it's just like, I can only equate it to hunger. I mean, I think we all feel that like, because I feel it with music too. Like at a certain point, I'll be like, oh, I want to understand more about jazz. And then you just go in and you're learning and you're like, you know, getting into records and this leads to that. And at a certain point you go, wow, I kind of get jazz, you know? And it doesn't mean you're sick of it, but the thirst for knowledge, and it's almost like the standing in the face of something that seems impenetrable. At a certain point, you have penetrated it. You have understood. You've experienced it. It doesn't mean you know everything about it, but your thirst is satiated.
You have a broader depth of field of being able to speak to this thing as a concept that you're interested in and can explain to yourself, which might even be more important.
Yeah, and for instance, with like all this fascination I've had around QAnon and stuff, like that came from a deep frustration and curiosity about how people I knew were becoming radicalized.
Right.
And so I was hungry for information to try and like problem solve how is it that this person I thought I knew has taken a turn that seems so inexplicable to me? And at this point, I do feel somewhat satiated for the mechanism of how that happens to a human being in the modern world.
In the way that we talked about the indoctrination materials and how cults function, are these people you knew, are they coming from MLMs, basically? Are they the types of people that you found becoming radicalized?
No, I wouldn't say that at all. I think that there's a portion that are like that, but there's, you know, Byron Bay yoga people.
Totally.
Lefty, like natural parenting kind of that, like, you know, crosses over with the anti-vax world. And the one of the things that I've found really interesting is that was explained to me by someone. It's a theory, but sort of what is it that connects this natural living with, for instance, like white nationalism, right?
Yeah.
And one of the things you see, a common thread, is fear of the other. So basically there is a territorial relationship to what you see as the natural state. So the human...
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, so the human body should be a certain way, but you cannot allow this genetically modified food or this chemical made by doctors to cross the borders of the human body and to contaminate the natural state of affairs for the human body. So it's an entire mindset about protecting an idealized version of a sort of state of being, which obviously you can extrapolate that metaphor into natural, into borders. Oh, immigrants right. coming in. Or, you know, so it's an attachment to a fantasy of what a natural state appears to be. Whereas the reality is that all pharmaceuticals, all chemicals, they all come from nature. Yes, they right. might be manipulated and worked on, but so does, you know, mostly to extract a natural metal out of the earth, there has to be some level of manipulation. So it's really this fantasy of what is natural should be left untouched. And there's a naivety to it, I think.
Which is well and good and playful when you're purchasing yogurt, but not when you're deciding who gets to come into your country or how you protect yourself and others from the spread of a deadly disease.
Yeah, and there's, you know, there's a lot of fantasies, and this is where we get back to the conversation about like white privilege, for instance. Like I remember reading this great thing about camping and about how camping became basically an attachment that Western culture has to getting back to nature. But actually, camping can only exist in a privileged society in which natural predators have been wiped out and in which you can basically create like a Westworld fantasy of living in the natural world. So in a sense, like camping as a fantasy of getting back to nature is totally a function of privilege and disconnection from nature. So, you know, there's a lot of like these things that we kind of like, we realize that we have narratives about what living naturally means that really is already like many, many steps removed from what natural living is about.
I also wanted to explore with you a little bit more into MLMs generally. I know you said yesterday that you're not passionate about explaining the confluence between MLMs and cults because in some ways capitalism itself is unsustainably exploitative. And I agree with you on that front. But I guess I think it's important to just clarify if you think that MLMs in particular play by a more specific set of rules that lend themselves to cult adjacent praxis.
Yeah, I mean, I think I for me, the jury's out on whether they need to. They definitely do, but I don't know whether it's in their nature that MLMs and direct selling become cult-like or lend themselves to that type of mentality, or is that the type of person that is attracted to it? Like it's a chicken and egg type thing. For sure, I think what you see in MLMs is it's like there's a buying into a party line that is very cult-like.
Would you describe it as almost fanaticism?
Yeah, probably. Mm. Yeah, absolutely. I think if for people that are, it's very hard to be good at it without being fanatical.
Right.
Like I think the system rewards fanaticism. So maybe that is a way that built into it, it is cult-like. Like I think the more fanatical, but then I'm sort of like Wall Street or day trading, which is equally unsustainable, also rewards fanaticism. Like I think sales in general rewards fanaticism because like we have a really good friend who is just, she's just a regular person. She's not a salesperson, but she is a natural enroller. So when she buys new bed sheets, she will sit you down and tell you, it's like a vacuum cleaner, like things that I cannot get passionate about. And I tease her about it because I'm like, you should be getting commissions on every single, but she's the type of personality that would be rewarded intensely within MLM structures.
I hear you.
Yeah.
You were saying that you canceled your membership.
Yeah.
You canceled your account as a result of what you said was a major philosophical dispute with the company. Are you in and of yourself drawing the through line between far-right and Nazi ideology and this company's business practices being sympathetic to those things?
Not innately, but given the opportunity to distance themselves, they didn't take it. So,
yeah.
You know, a lot of what like we've been dealing with in the US, when you get to a time in history when essentially evil has taken front and center stage, you know, like it did in Germany in the 40s. And, you know, it's like there are times in history.
Absolutely.
Or during apartheid, you know, in South Africa. It's not enough to be silent. You have to speak up. And I feel similarly with I found celebrities that didn't speak up. Look, if you're pro-Trump, that's one thing. I disagree with you. But celebrities who protected their brands through not being political, I lost a lot of respect for. And I just think at a time and place like the one we're currently in, one of the, you know, isn't there a famous expression about this? Is like all that it takes for evil to flourish is for good men to do nothing.
Yes.
I see it as like that. Like I'm not going to say that everyone who didn't speak up against Trump is a racist. I don't believe that everyone is consciously racist. But I do believe that if you didn't speak up, you are enabling a racist administration to flourish. And that is racist in and of itself, but not consciously,
yeah,
and not intentionally. Like I know many people who the racism that they have expressed is basically through a reluctance to examine racial issues. So like you have large members of minority communities saying it is the time and place to examine these issues. There is a strong argument to be made that if you refuse to step up to that challenge, that is innately racist in this moment in history. But that's not the same as equating everybody with actually being a white supremacist.
Right.
I mean, they're racist through ignorance.
And it's like, it's about drawing that through line, I think, in terms of being able to delineate for yourself where your lines and your boundaries lie and how you move through that with the people that you know. Are you saying to these people who you know who have been indoctrinated or who are on the precipice, you're saying, come on, we've got to do something, and it's because we can't be on the same team as people who will have Nazis on their team?
The way I generally operate in terms of my relationship to activism is not to tell people to be like prescriptive about what to think. I just try and demonstrate what my value system is. So me canceling my account, me being open about that, I'm being clear about my value system. And I think
the conversation we're having right now.
Yeah, and I think as an artist, that's probably your biggest power anyway. Like I don't think I don't think making too many rules about it for others is very successful. But if I say I will not stand for this, then it's very clear where, and there is a magnetism that occurs through standing up for your own, for what you believe in, that you do mm-hmm. find people drawn to you that want to take a stand for the same thing. And you do find yourself in an adversarial relationship with people who find that threatening. Like, you know, for instance, with doTERRA, I did have a woman comment on one of my socials. I can't remember. She said, I hope they cancel your account. And I was like, well, I don't even know what that, I don't know what that means. I'm offering to cancel my account. Are you saying that it's inappropriate to call someone out? Are you saying that I'm damaging the reputation of the company? It's just some people do not want to have these conversations, and that's fine. But it's funny how with history, when you look back, say, you know, Nazi Germany is an easy one, but, you know, South Africa is another one. You can look back in history and it seems very clear that the people who spoke up were doing the right thing and that the people who were silent were complicit. There's really, you know, unless you are an avowed white supremacist, that's like, that's pretty clear. At the time, though, people have families, people have incomes, people have responsibility to their employees, to their shareholders. There are a whole range of sort of confounding sort of forces that can make it difficult for individuals and for businesses to do the right thing. And I'm not in denial about that. I understand that it's difficult, yet it must be done. So I, you know, with full respect for people that are scared to speak up, I still think it's important.
And I agree with you. Are you finding this? I want to circle right back to something you talked about on day one. Are you finding this materializing itself in your songwriting?
Yeah. Well, it's so fun. Like, I've got this album. I'm almost finished with it. Mm. And it's complicated, right? Because the album is like, I've got this song. One of my favorite songs on the album is called Born for This Bullshit. And it's basically about all of this. It's like, I'm here, man. I'm here to do this. I'm not afraid.
Yep.
Like, you can, you know, like, there's a lyric in the song, desires, you repressed them. I joined three cults and left them. it's a song about what does it take in show business? What does it take in the face of climate change? What does it take in the face of, to just keep going and pushing forward? So anyway, there's a lot of interesting ideas on the record that are complicated. But the album title that I'm at the moment living with, I've lived with it for a month or two and I like it. I think I want to call the album I'm Fun.
I like that.
Because the basic principle is that, like, this is life, man. I'm into it. I'm into it. And and what I've been on about my whole career is, like, I'm fun. Like, if you want to get into this with me, if you want to get into life, if you want to do this, it's going to be messy, but it's going to be pretty dynamic and pretty enjoyable. And these themes have been, you know, I had a song on Awake Is A New Sleep, Ache For You, where the lyric, where I had the line, my love's confusing, but it never gets dull. And honestly, like, not being boring is essentially possibly the underlying message of my entire life's work. And I think there is something about tying all of this work together as fun, because it's actually fun to use your voice. It's fun to test the limits of your sanity. It's fun to test the limits of what society says your role can be, to create your own definitions of what your existence can mean. It's fun. So that's sort of where I find it all coalescing.
Are you writing songs of protest?
Not overtly, you know, like my protest, the songs are not political. Like Born for This Bullshit, it's more, my art is more about the feeling. It's not about, it's not about exactly the steps to take, you know, like, I'm trying to think, like, I think art should ask more questions then it should give answers.
My favorite technique in songwriting is when someone asks a question.
Yeah. So I have this song about, you know, one of the questions I ask about psychedelics or about the expansion of consciousness is, you know, and also in the project I've been doing with Tom Robbins is, why are we drawn to these things? And so I have this song on the new album called Parents Get High. and the chorus is just, what makes your parents get high?
Yeah, for sure.
And the way I resolve that is by saying, oh my, oh my.
Yeah.
I don't have an answer to it.
Yeah.
We're living this out. And I think art is, and you know, even Midnight Oil, say, who you would call an incredibly political band overtly, still the chorus of their most definitive political statement is, how do we sleep while our beds are burning?
Yeah.
They're not going to tell you. They're just saying, how is it that we find ourselves in this situation? That's what makes art good. Mm. And I would rather, you know, in terms of getting into the minutiae of it, I would rather use things like podcasts and social media and interviews and if I want to write something. But as far as songs, it's more about creating a space for people to find answers within themselves.
I mean, is that not the point of songwriting?
Yeah, hopefully. So it is to me.
Yeah, I think so. I think me too. Ben, that's a good spot to leave it for today. I think we should come back tomorrow and I want to get into your time as a death midwife and the ways in which that
Ben
has
Lee in quarantine is a collaboration between me, Max Quinn, and Ben
Thank
Lee.
Thank you, Ben.
I'm doing all the mixing and producing and editing and stuff. Sorry if you run into any pops or clicks or bung audio. I'm trying. Thank you to Ben. You can find him on the internet at Ben Lee Music. You can say hi to me at Max Quinn. We'll have another episode for you real soon.